Hey guys, welcome back to the Why Wars Happen History podcast, where you learn about the causes of wars and things like, why did it happen? Was it inevitable? Who was involved? Sometimes I go back hundreds of years just so we can understand what the hell happened. And if you want to talk more about war, we also have authors, historians, war generals, royalty, actors, filmmakers, a whole bunch of people come on as guests, and we talk about everything about war before, during, and after war. So let's go. Welcome to the Why Wars Happen History podcast, where we have narrated history episodes, and we also have interview episodes where we sit down with filmmakers, authors, historians, and we talk about history and war. Today's guest is Martin Dugard, who's a New York Times bestselling author of the Taking series, and we'll get into that in a little bit here, and he's also the co-author of a super popular Mega Million Selling Killing series, and he's the author of today's book, Taking Midway, Naval Warfare, Secret Codes, and the Battle That Turned the Tide of World War II. Martin, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, thanks. Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah. So I have to ask, Bill O'Reilly is you're a co-author with Bill O'Reilly, and he said that you're the most successful co-author of nonfiction books of all time. What did he mean by that? Like volume? Like what?
I'll take it. You know, when he says that, I always think of like the Bible, you know, it's all those co-authors. No, it's just, you know, we sold all these books and it's a big series. It's so, you know, I think it's 20 million or something like that. So yeah, when it comes to nonfiction, I think the best selling, I mean, I'm probably speaking out of school, but I think it is the best selling in history, which would make me the best-selling co-author. But I'd like to think of him as my co-author, so it kind of goes both ways.
That's how we'll say it today. Bill O'Reilly is your co-author. That is really cool. And you have this Taking series, Taking London, Taking Paris, Taking Berlin, and now Taking Midway. Was this kind of a thing that you're like, that's on the horizon, I know I'm going to have to do it? Did you dread it or was it exciting?
No, you know what? I started working with Bill in 2010. And we at the time, we shared an agent. So the connection was easy. You know, it was never political. It was always about history. And we collaborate well together. And the books, you know, it was just supposed to be Killing Lincoln. But it did so well, made the bestseller list, you know, right away. So then we immediately got a contract for Killing Kennedy, then Jesus, and it just kind of just spiraled. But I think I knew at some point, because I'd done so many books of my own before that, you know, it's nice to, because those books are written, you know, I write them, I research them, we turn them into Bill's voice, Bill makes his own edits. But, you know, let's face it, those are Bill's books. They're in his voice. It's supposed to sound like Bill. And I like to write in my own voice. So that at some point I knew that I was going to have to go solo, and it was going to maybe even to the point that I'd have to write two books at the same time for a while, which is hell.
Oh yeah. That's wow.
Yeah. But I tried to write the Taking series with a very distinctive voice. And it's, you know, someone who works with Hollywood, you would understand this. It's much more cinematic. It's supposed to kind of rise above the page and be much more, and that digressions I make are stuff that Bill would never allow. So sometimes they get to riff, and it's nice to put your own voice on the page, is what I'm saying. So the Taking series has been tremendously fun for me.
That's awesome. That's a great word to describe it too. Cinematic. That is what it felt like reading it.
Oh, thanks.
Yeah. And so can I ask, we open up and we're on this British ship, the Prince of Wales. These guys are stationed out in the South China Sea. What are they doing there?
Well, you know, we think of December 7th as Pearl Harbor, but December 7th was attacks all across the Pacific. You know, the Japanese struck, you know, Wake Island, they struck, you know, in on the Malayan Peninsula, they were in Borneo, they were everywhere. And the reason I chose to open with Singapore two reasons. Taking London, which is about the Battle of Britain, actually closes with a scene on the Prince of Wales with Roosevelt meeting with Churchill after the Battle of Britain. So I wanted continuity between the books so readers could finish Taking London and go straight into, well, what's happening with the Prince of Wales now? Churchill's not here, but, you know, it's about to get sunk. It's in a really bad position.
That's cool.
And the time the Prince of Wales was the biggest battleship in the world. There was a Japanese ship that was bigger, but it was huge, you know, so it was considered unsinkable, which to me is always the kiss of death when they say that about a ship,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
And the funny thing is once you get to know a character, whether the character is Churchill or Roosevelt or even a ship, because when you write about something, you describe it in a very intimate fashion. You don't want bad things to happen to it or the individual. So even as I wrote about, you know, the doomed Prince of Wales, there's an air of sadness about it because it was preventable. But I wanted the reader to kind of go from one book to the other. Churchill weaves in and out of all four of the taking of books. And so it was nice to just keep that nice segue from one book to the next.
That's interesting because again, that does remind me of movies. Where
sometimes you have a sequel that picks up
right where the other one left off, and I always appreciate that. So that's really cool.
And just for our listeners
and potential readers out there that might not be familiar with it, why is the Battle of Midway considered such a turning point in World War II?
You know, what's fun about writing history books is I did not know the answer to that question when I started the book. You know, I just heard about it. I'd seen the movies.
Yeah.
I knew it was important and I knew it was something worth writing about. But at the same time, I didn't understand the significance. So it's called Midway because it's literally in the middle of the ocean. It's halfway between San Francisco and Tokyo. And once the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor, our fleet was very vulnerable. And we were kind of at risk wherever we sailed the seas because Japan controlled the Pacific. And so we, even though we sent ships out from Pearl Harbor to go do hit and run raids, but for the most part, we were vulnerable. And the only other outpost we had that was of significance other than Pearl Harbor was Midway. And because it's in such a pivotal location, if the Japanese had captured Midway, and there was every indication they would, if we hadn't kind of broken their code and figured out what was going on, they would have had a forward base halfway across the ocean, 1,200 miles from Oahu, from the Hawaiian island. They could have attacked it well. They could have kept ships there. They could have launched planes from there. We would have been very vulnerable. And so if something like that happened, we would have been either A, penned up in Pearl Harbor. We wouldn't be able to send ships out to sea because we'd have to defend Pearl Harbor and Oahu. Or if we lost that, we would have actually had to pull our whole Navy back to the American coast, the North American coast, to, you know, San Francisco or San Diego or Long Beach.
Okay.
And then we would have been, you know, kind of screwed.
Yeah. Okay. So bringing that into, you know, some people might ask why, if this was such a huge decisive battle, a few years later, are we having to drop the atomic bomb on Japan to officially end World War II? Like, why did this battle even, like, what would have been different if we hadn't been involved or if we had lost?
If we had lost Midway? Well, what would happen if we lost Midway? They probably would have sunk all of our aircraft carriers. You know, we had three in that battle. We were building aircraft carriers, but we didn't have a whole lot in the Pacific at the time. So that meant that they would have sunk our aircraft carriers, you know, when instead during the battle, we sunk theirs. And aircraft carriers take a long time to build. And so Japan didn't have time the rest of the war to rebuild those carriers that they lost. So that was really pivotal. But it allowed us to push forward and wage that war that we waged where we kind of island hopped up the Pacific, getting closer and closer to Japan with everyone. Now, the argument for and against the nuclear bomb, you can say, okay, we were going to attack the Japanese homeland. Even children were being taught how to repel the invaders. We would have lost a million American lives, which is, you know, quite a bit more than the Japanese that were killed. On the other hand, when you drop an atomic bomb, you open a Pandora's box of things that can never be put back in the bomb box.
Yeah.
So did we do that to defeat the Japanese, or did we do that to scare the Russians? You know, that argument
can go on.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's one of those hotly debated topics still today.
Okay.
So what was Japan doing in Indochina and in that whole area during this time, just to kind of set the stage a little bit?
Well, the comparisons between Japan and England are pretty close in some respects, just because they're island nations. And when you're an island nation, you're limited to your own natural resources. You have to go other places to get, which is why the British built the empire. They were, you know, pulling in resources from countries all around the world. Well, Japan was trying to do the same thing in Asia. You know, they needed oil, they needed steel, they needed coal, they needed aluminum, they needed rubber. So where do you get those? You go to Borneo for the oil, you go to Indochina for the rubber. You know, you go to places, you take control of them, and you take those resources. So when we cut off steel exports to Japan, that was kind of, and then tried to do the same with oil. We froze their assets. That was kind of the kiss of death for the Japanese, because as a nation, they would not be able to sustain their military and their growth without those resources. So they had to go find them and get them to sell.
That's a pretty good explanation. One thing that shocked me to learn that I didn't know this when I was reading your book is, okay, so Churchill actually went on the Prince of Wales in the middle of World War II, 1941, and there's all these like high-ranking officials that were with them. That's kind of risky. Was that?
Yeah, no, it was. You know, Churchill. You know, he's one of those guys that, you know, you love him or you hate him, and I'm very bemused by Churchill just because he was a very astute politician, but he also lived this fantasy adventure life. You know, when he was younger and thinner, he lived a life of adventure. And once he grew older, and he still wanted to do things like he was off D-Day. He wanted to be off D-Day during the D-Day landings. He got the Prince of Wales to sail across the Atlantic through these waters infested by U-boats. If they had sunk that ship, they would have walked up to Churchill, but all of his staff, all the military genius of the British. Yeah. It was risky. He had a great time. By the way, too, though, they didn't have the kind of communication we have now. So when he did that, he effectively got a vacation from the war, which he hadn't had since it began, and he wouldn't have again until the very end. So he remembered this time very well.
But why risk that? That's like, kind of a weird move to make.
It was completely political, and it's the thing, you know, like, okay, his relationship with Roosevelt was they communicated by telephone and telegraph, but they'd only met in person one time before, and that was 20 years earlier, and Churchill completely forgot about it, probably because he was drinking too much, and Roosevelt did not like him at all. And so the purpose of the meeting was for Churchill and Roosevelt to sit down in the same room, size each other up, and watch each other, because Churchill, more than anything, needed the U.S. to enter the war. And Roosevelt didn't want to do that. Next best thing was to get the U.S. to give the British 50 destroyers, you know, lend-lease, all the things that they needed to stay afloat. Because, again, an island nation, they were stuck without the resources of Europe because Hitler had all those resources. So the primary purchase of that meeting purpose was literally just go sit with Franklin Roosevelt, you know, watch a movie with him, you know, have a meal with him, just get to know him so they can become stronger allies.
Man, I mean, like, I know how it turns out. I know the ending, but it's still, like, scary to think about. Really, it's really a super great idea.
There's a scene with the captain of the Prince of Wales. You know, they come across this, they're going home, and they come through this whole caravan of ships, this big convoy going across the ocean, and you know, into this convoy, you insert the enormous Prince of Wales, which goes twice as fast as all those merchant marine ships. And Churchill goes to the bridge, and all these ships are honking their horns and sailors are waving at him. And the captain, realizing that Churchill's having the time of his life, blows past the convoy, does this big loop around to the back and goes right through the middle again just to make Churchill happy. Yeah, it's good for your career, I think, to do crazy things like that.
Wow. That you're freaking me out even more. Draw attention to us. That's wow. Okay. Moving on just a little bit here. You have a lot of major characters in this book. And you do a really good job of kind of bringing them alive and just into their minds a little bit about why they might have made certain decisions. Let's start with Admiral Chester Nimitz. Yeah. What was this whole thing with this, like, risky gamble he took, not listening to these conservative estimates of what was going to happen, and he listened to Rochefort instead? Yeah, just, like, give us a little view of his character, maybe, in that moment.
You've got to, you know, Nimitz is from Texas. His father died young, and, you know, he grew up kind of with that Wild West, you know, you're on your own mentality. And he, you know, when he became a naval officer, he went through the academy and he rose through the ranks. I mean, and he was, you know, just the consummate officer. And he was all about innovation. You know, he was one of the first big proponents of submarines. He built the submarine base in Oahu, you know, when he was just a lieutenant commander, probably in his mid-30s. And so he was one of those guys who, he knew the pecking order, but at the same time, he was a very intelligent man who was very... very thoughtful in his assessments of the situation. And he frankly didn't feel like the people in Washington, D.C. were qualified to tell him what was going on in the Pacific. And he also knew that if he didn't take a few risks, the Japanese ultimately penned the U.S. fleet up in Oahu, then he'd be stuck. So he had to do something aggressive. And also there was a fear too, if he didn't do something aggressive, he didn't get results, he was going to lose his job, you know, and tons of people would have wanted that job, and he knew he needed to do something decisive to show that he was, you know, the ranking admiral in the Pacific, and he was there for a reason.
It was ultimately a good attitude to have had and a good call that he made. And, okay, so I want to talk about code breaking a little bit. Tell us a little bit about how important code breaking was and what the rivalry was between Rochefort and, was it the Redmond brothers? Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, Rochefort, he was a code breaker. I mean, that was his whole thing. He was a naval intelligence guy. And, you know, code breaking was so essential to the war, both in the Pacific and the Atlantic. You know, you have all these people, these geniuses. And when I read some of the ways they broke codes, I had to read like 4 or 5 times to completely wrap my head around what they were doing. But these were really smart guys. And then you had these people in Washington, D.C. who were but they were playing politics, whereas Rochefort just wanted to break the code and beat the Japanese. That was his thing.
Okay.
Everybody else was playing politics. They want to rise through the ranks. Rochefort could have cared less if he rose through the ranks. He just wanted to avenge Pearl Harbor. He didn't want another surprise attack at Midway. And so that's when he threw himself into it. And so Nimitz was stuck between a rock and a hard place because Rochefort was kind of off the reservation. He was very conventional. You know, he was a guy who came into work in a uniform, but it was kind of rumpled, you know, and he put on a smoking jacket and he'd smoke all day. And he had mountains.
That's the kind of code breaker.
Yeah, exactly. And these guys in Washington, you know, they're fit and polished. You know, they're working in an office with the window. You know, Rochefort's office was in a basement. He had no windows. He had no access to daylight. You know, he was just one of those people who lived like a hermit in a cave almost. So,
wow.
I think he's a cool guy. And, you know, the cool thing about Rochefort, it's not the cool thing, it's just a little bit of trivia. He's buried in Englewood in a small cemetery there by the Forum. And I'm probably sure I've driven past it a million times. I just need to go visit his grave because he's one of those guys that he deserves at least someone to lay some flowers in his grave.
Oh, yeah, that's nice. Man, it sounds like there's some really cool thinkers on that ship. Out in the, on our side. And I want to talk a little bit about Admiral Yamamoto. Am I saying that right? Yamamoto? Okay. This guy, he's considered like the guy behind the attack on Pearl Harbor, the architect. And now he's out. Well, he's having a hand in the Battle of Midway. And what can you tell us a little bit about what his plans were and whether it was just luck that they failed or they were just bad plans?
No, you know, Yamamoto, he was very savvy. So to give people a visual, you know, he's a smaller man. He's bald. He liked to walk on his hands. He was a gambler. You know, he was very intellectual. He was always thinking strategy. He was always like one of those people four or five steps ahead of everybody else. And so even after he, like when he planned Pearl Harbor, he knew that unless Japan won the war quickly, that the U.S. might, the industrial light of the U.S. would turn around and crush the Japanese as it did. He was very prophetic in that. So he wanted a follow-up to Pearl Harbor was a second assault. And he wanted another big surprise attack. And Midway was his choice, but other factions within the Japanese military were looking at other places to go. And he was quite clear in saying, you know, we need to go to Midway. So he was the architect of that. And, you know, the Midway attack dwarfs the Pearl Harbor attack. I mean, it was enormous. They had, you know, hundreds of ships, you know, and they had invasion forces. You know, imagine the American forces that went ashore in Normandy on D-Day. Well, the Japanese had a similar force steaming towards Midway to make the same sort of, you know, amphibious landing. So it was a big deal.
Wow. So, okay. So there was an attack that Americans were kind of gearing up for and the Japanese didn't know. And one of Yamamoto's officers was like, hey, let's go attack these American ships at dusk or at nighttime. And Yamamoto's like, nah, we're not going to do that. We're going to hang back. And that was a bad decision because they didn't know that the Americans were already on their way to attack them. And that turned out to be disastrous for Japan. Can you tell us, hypothetically, if Yamamoto had listened to his officer, do you think that whole thing would have turned out differently? Do you think it would have had an impact on the battle?
I don't think so. I think just because we knew their plans going, because of Rochefort, we knew their plans, we knew what they were going to do. You know, I think the biggest mistake that they made was not making sure they had their own intelligence become quite aware of the fact that we had not just one or two carriers, we had three carriers there. And so you think about it like this. So when the Yorktown, which is the third carrier, had been badly damaged at Coral Sea, it's in dry dock. It's in Hawaii in dry dock. A carrier is a big, big ship. So when it comes into port or leaves port, everybody can see it. You can't hide a carrier. So with all the thousands of people who were working on the ship to repair it almost overnight, and all the citizens of Honolulu, at least some of whom were Japanese spies, how is it that they never managed to get news about the Yorktown to the Japanese fleet and let them know that, hey, they've got three carriers and they're coming for you?
Yeah.
And that was the big thing.
Yeah, that is quite a puzzle. It's hard to imagine with all of our communication abilities today, just really thinking back, the 1940s was still not quite as technologically advanced as us, but it wasn't as bad as medieval days of taking weeks to get something.
Right.
It's kind of hard to think of that.
Yeah. When you think about a lot of code breaking at the time resolved around radio intercept. So they would listen to, the Japanese do their Morse code. It's like they could figure out where ships were. The question is, why was Japan so smug that they didn't put as much money into developing their own code breaking system? Because they had a fairly sophisticated code system of their own, but they could never really crack the American code to the extent that we could crack theirs.
So code breaking really was maybe even more important than just sheer firepower. in the Battle of Midway that we're talking about here?
It's both. I mean, if like we knew who was coming and what was coming, but we still had to find their ships and you still had to send those dive bombers. And, you know, one of my favorite scenes in the book is when they finally locate the Japanese carriers, who are so mythic because these are the same carriers that launched planes against Pearl Harbor. And they were, you know, they were called the Kiributai. They were just the stealth force that could go wherever they want, do whatever they want. And the pilots, you know, it was just one of those things where there was such a confidence with the Japanese fleet. So when American Dauntless dive bombers, you know, dropped down from 20,000 feet and laid bombs right in the center of their flight deck, and the everything exploded because as the bombs punctured the flight deck, it hit planes and ammunition and fuel. And one of the pilots said, you know, the flames were 300 feet high, and literally the decks, because of the heat, curled back like a can being opened with a can opener. Just
wow.
That kind of stuff. You don't get there without the naval intelligence that tells you the ships are there, but then you need the pilots and the bombs to do the job.
Wow, yeah. Okay, so other than code breaking, or the lack of code breaking, I should say, were there other major differences between the style that the Japanese was fighting versus how we were fighting that battle?
Well, here's the thing. The Japanese went into the battle thinking they were going to fight an offensive battle. And then we went on the offensive before they could do that. They attacked Midway by air, but we knew the attack was coming because we were more concerned about fighting their aircraft carriers at sea, and that's where we went on the offensive. So their aircraft carriers thought they were on the offensive because they were launching these planes to take out the island of Midway, whereas the U.S. carriers were far more intent about getting the Japanese carriers. Yeah, but it was kind of a different way of thinking too. Like, you know, for instance, a Japanese pilot went through years of training to become a pilot. It was a very, very sophisticated and often brutal type of discipline to become a pilot. Whereas in America, we rotated pilots in. You know, flight school is very difficult, but at the same time, we put so many pilots through the pipeline that when the Japanese lost pilots, it took so long to become a Japanese pilot, they didn't have the pilots to replace them. Whereas when we lost pilots, we had people, but when somebody was a little bit war weary, you know, if you'd been in combat for 6 months or a year, they actually rotated back to the States to serve as flight instructors to show people how to, Japanese tactics so they could use those in combat.
I see. That does seem to be almost a theme with the U.S. during World War II, where we were just churning out soldiers. We were churning out weaponry, we're turning out aircraft, like we're just massive production. So that's interesting.
Don't forget, it was like we came late to the party because, you know, the Japanese had been building up for war for years. We didn't really get aggressive about developing our air power, for instance, until about 1940. And even then, we weren't making fighters and bombers, we were making transports. So, whereas the Japanese were building a war machine for years before that, but again, the resources were limited. So that, I'm sorry, I'm getting so deep into the weeds here. That's I'm nerding out.
No, I love it. I love it.
But the Japanese were getting so, they're running out of resources. That was the thing. It was like, we had so many resources. We could just build and build and build, and they had limited resources. And that's why they needed to maintain their strength.
And what was it, trying to remember the ratio of the amount of aircraft carriers and aircraft that we produce versus what Japan produced, and it just completely dwarfed Japan.
They built almost no carriers after Midway, whereas we entered the war, I think CV-9, CV-10. CV is the Navy vernacular for an aircraft carrier. By the end of the war, I think we were up to I want to say CV-29, but it may even be past, because CV-43 Midway itself, the USS Midway, that was launched just after the end of the war. Commissioned, I should say.
It's incredible when you really think about everything that we built in just such a short amount of time. Okay, so you've written several books about World War II. Like, I say several, but it's quite a lot of books about World War II. And I want to ask if there's another war that you might take on next after this, or is there more of World War II that you're going to do?
I don't know. You know, here's the thing. The fun of the Killing series was that Bill had that bully pulpit of a television show that he could sell books every. So we could write about anything in history. You know, again, right. we did, you know, Lincoln, then Kennedy, then Jesus, then Patton, then,
yeah.
And then Reagan, then, you know, American Revolution, you know, we just jumped around. And usually to do that, you've got to be someone who specializes in, you know, let's say the Civil War. You got to be just the Civil War guy. And I'm certainly not, you know, the expert on World War II. I'm just one of those guys who likes to tell a good story about World War II. But my next book is actually has nothing to do with military history. It's about running in the 1970s and 1980s. And it's a great story. It's a great story, but and it's never really been told the way that I think it can be told. I'm in the middle of kind of pulling my hair out, trying to find the narrative structure. But I think when it comes together, it's going to be pretty good.
That's cool. I did read about how you were like this kind of super runner and you're super into running. And so that's interesting to see what you write.
I'm not the runner I was, now more of a coach, but I do enjoy running though. I like the trails.
Yeah, me too. I'm out in Colorado now and there's a lot out here that they just didn't have in the city.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Okay, well, thank you for coming on the show and answering all these questions. Martin Dugard, author of Taking Midway, and you can find it anywhere you find books, starting May 20th. Is that right?
May 20th, yeah.
May 20th.
Books on sale worldwide.
Yes, you go to Amazon, Barnes & Noble, anywhere. Okay, thank you again so much for coming on the show.
It was a lot of fun. Yeah, have a great rest of your day.
You too.
All right,
thanks, Ellen. Bye.